It is Thursday, May 16th, 2024. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Matthew Moore.
I'm Kyle Kellums. Today, striving to diversify the kinds of investors and startup companies in Northwest Arkansas.
The amount of investable capital represented is, by our estimate, $1.5 trillion, with a T.
Plus, we remember when a founding member of Monty Python's Flying Circus talked with us about history.
Not many people have heard of the Dacians. I certainly hadn't heard of the Dacians before we started doing these programs. That's because the Romans wiped them out.
And after 3 decades at the University of Arkansas, Janine Perry is departing.
Other senior professors at other campuses in the country, and they all really made the comment that, you know, her record is unparalleled in terms of what you would end up seeing in terms of involvement with students.
All of that after these headlines from NPR.
The Scott Family Amazium in Bentonville invites families to create unforgettable memories year-round and explore hands-on experiences for all ages. Tickets and information at amazium.org.
This is Ozarks at Large for Thursday, May 16th, 2024. I'm Matthew Moore. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF Public Radio. In about 7 minutes on our show, we hear from Janine Perry, a professor at the U of A and a friend of the show, as she talks about her departure from Fayetteville. First today, Bentonville is no stranger to multi-million dollar investments, but a collection of investors and startup companies is looking to diversify the region's output and capitalize on its unique position. Ozarks at Large's Daniel Carruth has more.
On any given day in the glimmering glass-plated Ledger building in downtown Bentonville, you can probably find plucky entrepreneurs looking to network. But last week, the volume of investors and the money on offer in that building ballooned.
The amount of investable capital represented is, by our estimate, $1.5 trillion, with a T.
That's Nathaniel Harding. He is the managing partner of Cortado Ventures, a venture capital investing firm based out of Oklahoma City, and the force behind this event, the MidCon VC Summit. That's VC as in venture capital.
Yeah, the MidCon VC Summit is really a way to highlight the opportunities here, both for investors and founders. We've observed now for the past few years has been an explosion in innovation, but also investment in tech companies. And so really it's a way to bring together both builders and backers. It's good for business, it's good for capital and talent, and we're happy to be able to host this today.
And that name, MidCon, stands for Middle of the Continent, and Harding says it's sometimes used to describe a business region outside of the coasts. Think Arkansas, Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, and Colorado.
So truly, it's not the Midwest, it's not the South, it's not the Rocky Mountains. But it's a specific region that really just has a lot of legacy industries. So think of, you know, aerospace, energy, logistics, supply chain, but also a budding biotech and health science, life sciences sectors as well. And we also believe that it's been overlooked by coastal VC, but yet you see a tremendous amount of talent and this new wave of innovation where digital meets physical world. And that's really what we underwrite as investors and where we see a lot of the talent starting companies.
And Harding believes Bentonville could possibly be the epicenter of that hub. And that's likely due to the work and family of today's keynote speaker, Stuart Walton.
And the way I think about Bentonville and our position today in the country, at least, is, you know, you have, I think of us as like a AAA rated startup.
Dressed casually in a blue button-down and jeans, the heir to the billionaire Walton family was there to talk about the future of Bentonville and, more importantly, to convince the crowd that their money has a future in Bentonville.
But we also think that the upside investing here is more exciting than, you know, some other potential options. And that actually leads to a pretty strong, like, geographic interest for Tom and I in terms of our day-to-day work on where we actually want to invest. So we focus heavily and almost kind of with a fair bit of discipline, not always, but a fair bit of discipline on companies and projects and real estate and businesses that are located here in Northwest Arkansas and really in Bentonville, Bella Vista specifically.
In fact, just that morning, it was announced that Stuart and his brother Tom Walton's real estate company, Blue Crane, had just purchased 2,700 acres of land and development rights in Bella Vista. And Harding says this type of growth and huge investment in the region is exciting to people, especially these investors.
Stuart Walton explained it really well in terms of, you know, the investment that's happening, the fact that Bentonville has more cranes building new buildings than even in Manhattan, and that's absolute number, not per capita, has the most, you know, per capita in the country. It really shows that there's a lot of investment in quality of life and building up the community, which attracts talent and attracts capital. And also, you know, a lot of the companies, a lot of the established corporations in Bentonville represent this, you know, retail value chain that we think it makes sense that it's happening here. And you see a lot of tech companies now moving into that space, which really embodies an important part of how we invest in the Mid-Continent.
Anita Lee is managing director for Generator, a startup accelerator program based out of Oklahoma City that helps entrepreneurs develop their business and find funders. She says the attention on Bentonville is good for the entire region.
Yeah, it's really great to be here in Bentonville because, one, you know, we are always trying to expand our networks, and we've done a really great job of embracing and collaborating within Oklahoma. And there's just such an easy kind of similarity of growth patterns here in Arkansas. They focus a lot more in different industries than Oklahoma does, so that also expands the type of resources available, as well as kind of the startup founder ecosystem.
And while Lee says this area has often been overlooked, the industry is starting to look away from the coast for a different opportunity.
So I actually grew up in the Bay Area, which is like the heart of all of the early stage startups. And I would say the biggest difference I've seen is the coast seems to be very cutthroat, right? There's such a saturation of talent and startups, and at times it feels like there's kind of a lack of capital. Whereas here, I think there's more collaborative efforts. Everyone knows that in order for one founder to succeed or one firm to be successful, like, all of them have to collaborate together and co-invest and share resources.
According to numbers reported by media outlet Axios, over the past 2 years, venture capital investors have pumped more than $300 million into businesses in Northwest Arkansas. For Harding, that's reason enough to bring these 370 participants from 30 states to this event.
So it's an amazing blend of builders and backers, check writers, check cashers that make everything possible.
He says next year's summit will be held in Tulsa. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Daniel Caruth.
You guys have a great rest of the summit and enjoy Bentonville.
Daniel Caruth produces his stories inside the Karen Taha News Studio. This is Ozarks at Large. Janine Perry is departing the University of Arkansas after 26 years of instruction as a professor of political science. She plans to return to her home state of Washington following the semester. Ozarks at Large's Lainey Kellybrew reports.
Perry says that her final push in her decision to leave came at an unexpected moment. She was traveling with her husband, but the reasons for her early departure came from more than that.
So there was one particular waitress, actually, at... We were in Grand Teton at the Rockefeller Center, which was unreal. And they have this like 50s diner set up, but there are no tables or booths. Everything is one long, like, sit at the counter. So you can imagine what that does for families. It's, who doesn't love to sit at the counter, right? I'm 52 years old and I love to sit at the counter. So that was the way this restaurant was set up. And I'm pretty sure it was always set up that way because the facility was built in the 60s. And this classically dressed, you know, server comes in, you know, the black and then the little white frilly thing. And it turns out when we're talking to her, she wasn't busy that day, that she was a 57-year-old retired paralegal, and she was living with her college roommate in the housing that's provided. And we just started asking her questions. And it, like, from that point forward, both my husband and I just got like fixated on, oh my gosh, like we could totally do this. And we got a plan, and we got a financial advisor was part of the plan, and tried to live pretty small, and small-ish compared to, I guess, other people in our circle, and just make this goal a reality. So, and we did. And then there's also, I have a sister who was diagnosed with a pretty troubling disease, and she's younger than I am, not that long after that. And it was just like, oh, well, now I have to go home. And it's just like, I knew that, like, I have to go home.
Outside of the Arkansas poll, Perry's most recent research has centered around the rise of party monopolies in states.
40-some of the states right now are in a situation in which their governors are almost always one party, and their legislatures are not, House and Senate are almost always majority control one party. But as we've talked about in class, not just majority control, but like 80% majority control, like super majority. So I define it as, you know, if it's that intense and it's lasted for 10 or more consecutive years, that's a party monopoly. And like Arkansas, if you look over the entirety of the data set that I have, has been in a position of party monopoly like 92% of the time. Hawaii, 100% of the time. You know, we looked at a bar chart like that. So what usually happens in those situations is, for example, voter turnout, even controlling for education and income, is lower in those states because there's no contest, right? Everybody knows that the Republicans are going to win, or in a handful of states that the Democrats are going to win. It appears that corruption is higher. People tend to kind of take liberties, and they know they're not going to get in trouble if they get caught with their hand in the cookie jar. So that's also demonstrably the case and has been throughout the 20th century. People care less about politics. They have less efficacy and interest in politics because it's just the same old thing happening. Policies get more, it used to be the case in the 50s, which was another time, the 40s and 50s, when there were a lot of state party monopolies, and not just in the South. What happened then was parties just weren't very responsive to what people wanted. They just didn't do anything. So now what's happening, this is a little bit interesting, a different twist. The majority party isn't responsive to the majority of the people, but it's almost like it's hyper responsive. So instead of doing nothing, it does too much. So the consequence of that is extreme kind of policies. So abortion regulation, gun regulation. So we're trying in red states, right, to say pretty much all abortions are illegal, when majority public opinion, it's well established, is like, man, like 75 to 85% of us think that it should be legal in this case, right, etc. So way out of step. It's what scholars call incongruous, right, that public opinion and public policy don't match. In fact, they're opposites of each other. And it's the same thing with gun regulation. You know, 80 to 90% of us support this kind of regulation, and red states are doing everything they can to do the opposite of that and say, well, now we have, you know, open carry, and, you know, people are like, how did that happen? What?
Olive Kester is a senior at the U of A and took gender and politics with Perry 2 years ago. Now she works with Perry on the Arkansas poll, which has been collecting Arkansas's opinions on policy.
It was like the second semester back in person after COVID. I hadn't really cared that much as a student, and I honestly hadn't really ever felt cared for as a student up until that point. But being in her class, one, totally re-inspired my love and passion for learning, and also just made me feel like wanted and cared for as a student and important, probably for the first time in my college career. You know, she makes the note cards with your face on them and has you fill them out at the beginning of the semester and is so diligent to ensure that she knows all of her students' names throughout the semester. And that really just touched me and made me want to work with Dr. Perry and continue to take her classes. So I then took Arkansas politics and then policy and politics and film. And the second semester of classes with her. I just reached out about an internship opportunity with the Arkansas Poll, and she graciously allowed me to help her. And then I've been working for her as her research assistant for the last almost 2 years now. And I've learned so many invaluable skills from her that I would never have learned in just normal classes, like research skills and how to read data and use SPSS and just all kinds of skills that are definitely going to transfer over to my time as a grad student. So endlessly thankful for her.
Andrew Dowdle is another political science professor. He says he was impressed by Perry and her knowledge from the moment he first met her.
Basically, even though at that point she was a relatively new faculty member, I was also ended up impressed with her professionalism in terms of the questions that she asked. When I asked her about questions about the university, the amount of knowledge that she ended up having, that was something typically that you wouldn't necessarily have expected somebody to have after only being here for 4 or 5 years. It would have been more typical if somebody's been here 15 years or so.
Olive Kester says Perry was just as beneficial in helping her grow academically as she was on a personal level with the well-being of her students.
I was an intern the first semester, or the first year in 2023, and then a research assistant in 2024. And I just helped her set up the summary report and run like the descriptive statistics that would go into the summary report and make some graphs for the findings that the Arkansas Poll returned, and a lot of data visualization.
Many have wondered who will take over the Arkansas Poll once Perry leaves the university. Olive tells us,
I know there have been a few people expressing interest, and I think it's a bit uncertain at this point. I know probably the Blair Center will ultimately decide what's going to happen. It's an expensive project, and it takes a specific kind of person to be able to do it and do it well. I think the university has been really lucky to have someone like Dr. Perry to run the Arkansas Poll for the last 25 years. And I definitely think there are big shoes to fill, but hopefully they can figure someone out because it's a really valuable tool for public opinion. So,
Perry has done research, impactful instruction, and been involved in multiple areas of campus, which leaves the university with a noticeable gap in the political science faculty.
Other senior professors at other campuses in the country, and they all really made the comment that, you know, her record is unparalleled in terms of what you would end up seeing in terms of involvement with students and involvement with all of these other organizations across the state. So she's going to be somebody that's really going to be impossible to end up replacing.
While Perry will surely be missed, she has greener pastures to tend to. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Lainey Killebrew.
Time now for today's Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. I'm Paul Gatling. A startup studio with a unique approach to building companies is now up and running in Northwest Arkansas and has some significant goals in mind. Highway Ventures is the name. Lane Patterson is one of three founding partners, and we will have a conversation with him on today's show. That interview, plus a rundown of other headlines this week, are coming your way after the break on today's Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report.
Support for the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report is provided by the Arkansas State Chamber of Commerce and Associated Industries of Arkansas. The Chamber's mission is to promote a pro-business, free enterprise agenda and prevent legislation, regulation, and rules that hinder business. ArkansasStateChamber.com. Arkansas Blue Cross and Blue Shield. For more than 70 years, Arkansas Blue Cross and Blue Shield has used its knowledge and compassion to create healthcare solutions for individuals and businesses. More information at ArkansasBlueCross.com. First Security is proud to be only in Arkansas. They offer smart solutions for personal and business banking, plus convenient services and community investment. First Security, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Highway Ventures, a startup studio that launches and grows advanced mobility companies, is forming in Northwest Arkansas. And we reported those details last week at nwabusinessjournal.com. Founding partners Lane Patterson, Dylan Terry, and Joe Comizio bring a unique blend of experience in startups, federal research, and investing to Highway Ventures. Their business model involves leveraging intellectual property and technology from federal research labs to build companies. Their goal is to establish 10 to 15 companies in Northwest Arkansas, focusing on creating high-paying technology jobs.
Highway Ventures is a startup studio that really takes three ingredients, federally funded research. Our federal government does about $200 billion a year in federal research right now. It's everything from Department of Defense kind of stuff all the way to the stuff that keeps our airplanes in the air with the FAA and any other three-letter agency you can think of. That money goes to develop the technology, but it doesn't commercialize the technology, which is where we step in. We take that technology, we match it with management teams and throw in a little bit of money and with the goal of creating new businesses all based in Northwest Arkansas.
Yeah, and explain that gap, I think, that you are seeing in that particular type of work. You mentioned the research, the federal research lab, getting from the research lab to commercialization, the valley of death, as you call it. So explain that aspect of it and how this, what the work that you're going to be doing solves for that problem.
Yeah, so all of these big labs are funded by the federal government, and all of the technology research is also funded by the federal government. They're legally required through what's called the Bayh-Dole Act to try to privatize that technology, but they're not given a nickel to do it. So what you end up with is an incentive for them to kind of do the minimum to privatize or commercialize that technology. So that's kind of the valley of death. Billions of dollars spent to develop really cool stuff and essentially zero spent to get it out and help us in kind of the civilian world. So that's where we step in, is we take technologies that are typically pretty mature from the technology side, but may not have a nice interface like we're used to in the consumer space, or may have been developed to work on a computer system that is unique to running on an air-gapped Navy ship, but doesn't run in a typical cloud environment like we are typically running our computer equipment in. So it's typically taking something that's a done product and needs a little press change and rearrange to get it out into the marketplace, and that's where we provide the funding and the business expertise to get over that valley of death.
All right, and so this technology and this IP that you're dealing with, all basically in a general term, you're launching and growing advanced mobility companies. So let's give some context to that, advanced mobility. That can be defined as what?
Yeah,
or alternative mobility, maybe.
Well, it's actually advanced. There have been some people that have said alternative, but our term is advanced.
Okay.
Advanced mobility is really the art and science of moving people or things from one point to another faster, more efficiently, and safely.
And to me, that sounds like Northwest Arkansas, right? I mean, we've got a lot of examples, a lot of companies, a lot of thought leaders are establishing operations, establishing businesses here around advanced mobility. Why is that? Why is Northwest Arkansas a good area for this type of focus and the type of focus that you'll be working on?
Well, I mean, the first and most obvious and easiest answer is that you've got really three corporate giants who do mobility all day, every day. You've obviously got Walmart, you've got J.B. Hunt, you've got Tyson, all moving lots of things from point A to point B and really at the top of their game. But then you kind of have that second tier of opportunity and experience here as well. The University of Arkansas has some unique capabilities around advanced mobility, and not just ground travel, but air travel and travel by boat as well.
Mm-hmm.
Lastly, you've really got a lot of innovation around some kind of cool stuff. One of my favorite parlor tricks here in Bentonville is to order something via drone delivery. So my visitors in town can see a drone deliver something to my front yard. You don't see that in many places. Or head out to Staden Field and look at the cool experimental aircraft that you see out there. So, you know, whether it's really the cutting edge technology or whether it's the nuts and bolts of it, it's all happening here.
How did you come to this work? What's your career background? And I always love to find out from people and ask this question, you know, when and what were the circumstances that brought you to Northwest Arkansas?
Yeah, so I come from a software startup background, had a long history of doing telecommunication software startups, and had some exit opportunities. From there, I ended up in Charleston, South Carolina, actually running a corporate venture capital group for the Irish government, of all people, called Enterprise Ireland. That then led me to really my breakthrough as far as this idea goes, which is I went to MITRE Corporation, which is a big federally funded research lab. And in that environment, we saw all these technologies that were just really cool stuff. I used to call it the Harry Potter closet of technology, but then it never got out, never saw the light of day. So me and one of the partners, Joe, at MITRE started spinning those companies out, and we had a lot of fun and we had some success getting these companies out. And at some point we decided to go off and do it on our own.
That is Lane Patterson, one of three founding partners in a new startup studio in Northwest Arkansas called Highway Ventures. You can learn more about their work at highwayventures.com. In other news this week, Walmart announced on Tuesday that it plans to cut hundreds of jobs at its corporate headquarters and relocate a majority of its U.S. and Canada-based remote workforce to three offices in either Bentonville, Hoboken, New Jersey, or the San Francisco Bay Area. Joe Lloyd, a longtime Tyson Foods executive, has been appointed as the president and CEO of the Jones Center in Springdale. He replaces Terry Trotter, who resigned this past November after a little over 2 years in the job. And Arvest Bank has promoted longtime executive Rodney Shepard to regional executive. He will oversee the company's banking operations in Oklahoma, Missouri, and Kansas. Arvest has two regional executives in its leadership structure. Craig Rivaldo of Bentonville is the other. You can find all of those stories and more at nwabusinessjournal.com, where you can follow our reporting each and every day. I'm Paul Gatling, and that's the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. Until next time, thanks for listening.
This is Ozarks at Large for May 16th, 2024. I'm Kyle Kellums. About once a month, we go back into our Ozarks at Large archives to remember what we were covering and who we were talking to during a particular month. Since many high schools are hosting graduation ceremonies this week and next, we thought we'd go back to May 2006, 18 years ago, a time when this year's high school graduates were just babies, if born yet at all. And it turns out May 2006 was a pretty interesting month. The SEC Outdoor Track and Field Championships were in Fayetteville, and it was going to be the debut for the new refurbished John McDonald Field. To get ready, we talked with Eric Brown, who would win the conference javelin championship that month, about his sport.
We need the rhythm of distance runners, you need that explosiveness of jumpers, and then the strength of the bigger throwers. So, and yeah, I think that's a big reason why I like throwing javelin, is you're almost a... You know, decathletes have to be good at every event, but we're almost a decathlete with our athletic ability, I would say. So we kind of have to have the best of every world.
Another first in May 2006, the play Bad Dates was being staged as the first production by Theater Squared. We caught up with T2's general manager at the time, Morgan Hicks.
We know what we want to do. We work together to build this vision and say this is what we want to give to the community. This is what we want the theater to be. But then you have to kind of go backwards and say, what's our timeline? How do we make this happen? What are the actual tasks that need to be accomplished in order to make this work? And I think that by incorporating a slow growth and building ourselves up over the course of 2 years, we've been able to put systems in place to be able to propel ourselves from one show to the next. Mm-hmm. And that was hard.
The Fayetteville Farmers Market was already well established in May 2006, but not all of the vendors were exactly veterans of the market. We heard from Joel Cal Young of Prairie Grove. He told us about his path to Northwest Arkansas and farming.
In Prairie Grove, this is second year, but I grow vegetable in Minnesota since 1986. I deliver to the farmer market in Minneapolis, and as they have their home building, so we rent the space and we sell Saturday, Sunday over there. I moved into the United States in August 1976. And the reason I moved into the United States because I was military and helping the CIA back in Laos, and the company hate those people who worked for the CIA.
That month, we also talked with a pair of notable writers who visited the University of Arkansas, and we want to share excerpts from those conversations. One of the authors was Terry Jones, a founding member of Monty Python's Flying Circus. Jones had written the book Barbarians and was hosting a TV show of the same name. His mission was to poke holes in Roman written histories of the world. I spent a few minutes with him at the Inn at Carnegie Hall while he was in between speaking engagements on campus.
Take everything with a piece of salt. I mean, also with the Roman historians, you've got to bear in mind Julius Caesar in the Gallic Wars describes an elk. And when he describes the elk, he says, "Elks have no knees, and if they they can't get down or get up again from the ground, and if they go to sleep leaning against trees." And so the way that people catch them in northern Germany is that they come along, they saw halfway through the trees, and when the elk leans against it, the tree breaks, and the hunters come and pick them up in the morning. So that was Julius Caesar on elk. So you have to be sort of take everything with a pinch of salt.
And then, of course, complicating the matters is you have the Roman version of things surviving, or more survival than anybody else, and then being repeated and repeated.
Mm. I think so, yeah. I mean, it's partly to do with the Renaissance and the sort of the Europe's love affair with the Renaissance and America's love affair with the Renaissance, the belief in that the Renaissance was this enlightenment that somehow new knowledge and new attitudes and man discovered his individuality, and it's all nonsense. You know, throughout the Middle Ages, men were individuals, and they were. You look at, you only have to read Chaucer's Canterbury Tales to realise that there was. Everybody had a sense of individuality. It was just nonsense to think that people didn't.
As you mentioned in the book, no one ever called themselves barbarians. That was kind of the Roman word for folks on the other side.
Exactly. I mean, I think every culture has its word for the others. Although, oddly enough, barbarian was originally a Greek word. It was actually coined for the Greeks. The Greeks said anybody who didn't speak Greek babbled. They went blah, 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 blah. So they called them barbarians. And the Romans, and they called the Romans barbarians. And then the Romans adopted the Greek word, called the Greeks barbarians. And anybody else who wasn't Roman, they called barbarians. So it's so the series about, the BBC series, is about the people who lived on the fringe of the Roman Empire, whom the Romans came into contact with, really. I think one of the reasons why I wanted to do the series was that there are parallels with the world today. I mean, I think there are, always are with history. And in the Roman world, you had Rome, in the classical world, you had Rome as the single unchallenged superpower in the world. And it carries out a foreign policy of preemptive strikes. And the curious thing is that here's this powerful country, richest, most powerful country, and yet it's driven by fear. And in the case of Rome, the Romans 9/11 happened in 390 BC when the Celts overran Rome and took Rome over for 6 months, half a year. The Celts ran amok in Rome, or took over Rome, and eventually were bought off for 1,000 pieces of gold. And this event was a stain in the Roman psyche. It haunted the Roman psyche, really, and prompted their foreign policy for the next 1,000 years, trying to neutralize all the states around Rome in order to make the borders safe, make sure that dreadful thing never happened again.
I was unaware of the, I guess, country or territory that was called Dacia.
Yeah, Dasha or Dasha. I mean, Dasha could have been Dasha. I don't know. The Dacians. Dasha, yeah, the Dacians. Well, not many people have heard of the Dacians. I certainly hadn't heard of the Dacians before we started doing these programs. And that's because the Romans wiped them out. And it's worth bearing in mind when you think about Rome as the bearer of civilization, which is what it always put itself out to be, that Trajan's Column in Rome, when you go and visit Trajan's Column, it's worth bearing in mind that this is probably one of the only public monuments in the world that is that commemorates an act of genocide. And all the pictures that go around Trajan's Column right up to the top, they depict the Romans methodically destroying the Dacians and killing them all and wiping them out and driving them out of Dacia. And it ends with the Dacian king, the Dacian leader, committing suicide. And so you see the picture of him cutting his own throat, which is the kind of thing the Romans liked on their monuments.
When we think of Romans, we think of Peter Ustinov in a toga. And then when you think of barbarians or Huns or Visigoths or Vandals, they are uncouth and illiterate, and the Romans are the ones who invented everything.
For instance, the Celtic civilization was in many ways much preferable to Rome. I mean, in Rome, don't forget, you could put if you had an unwanted child, an unwanted baby, you put it on the town rubbish dump. And that was fine. That was a perfectly acceptable thing to do. And in fact, people would go around the rubbish dumps in the morning to see if any unwanted babies had been left on the rubbish dump. And if they saw a healthy-looking specimen, they'd pick them out and bring them up to be slaves. And that was considered socially totally acceptable, as indeed was death in the arena. Death as a public spectacle was also seen to be actually not just acceptable, but it was actually defined Romanitas. It defined being Roman to actually go and witness people being killed in the arena meant you were a Roman, and especially if you were a young man, it was a responsibility to actually go and have to do that.
Terry Jones, author, comic, and founding member of Monty Python's Flying Circus, talking with me in May 2006 while he was on the University of Arkansas campus. Terry Jones died in January 2020. Another visiting author that month also talked about death. Thomas Lynch, who, by the way, is still very much with us, is the author of several books, poems, and essays. His book, The Undertaking, Life Studies from the Dismal Trade, was a National Book Award finalist in 1998. It's a collection of a dozen essays inspired by Lynch's job as an undertaker in a small Michigan town. David Ball says Lynch's writing was an inspiration for him to create the HBO series 6 Feet Under. Thomas Lynch visited the U of A in 2006. Here's part of our conversation that aired in May that year, beginning with Lynch talking about sometimes being summed up in brief as the undertaker poet.
It is easier if you can sort of package it up that way, like, you know, the wrestler who becomes governor, the cop who sings opera. It's just, and I don't mind that if it's the way that people sort of get into a conversation, but if it becomes the only part of the conversation, it's soon a yawner for everybody concerned. So
there's a certain marketability to it.
There is that, but underneath that, there is, I think, this quiet little disbelief that, for example, people who direct funerals can speak in sentences, or that people who write poems might have a day job. But in fact, every poet that I know. Leads, and every writer that I know, truth told, leads a kind of hyphenated life, you know, because certainly in this culture, it's not the kind of place where people get paid a living wage for writing. There are exceptions, of course, but in the vast majority of cases, people have to, you know, keep body and soul together with some gainful labor, whether it's teaching at a university or doing root canals or burying the dead.
Well, so much, I guess, of that kind of wanting to have that juxtaposition is that most people don't know a poet nor an undertaker. You know, so
I suppose, but as my father used to say when he was trying to work up some good marketing slogan, I think it was better to know us and not need us than to need us and not know us. It's true for poets also. You know, when you're looking for someone to write some elegiac thing, you know, you don't want to go to the yellow pages for, you know, obituarist. You know, you want to know someone who does that sort of thing. Yeah.
Essayist, op-ed, contributor to the New York Times, Boston Globe, Washington Post, belief.net.
Oh, yes, BeliefNet.
Yeah, yeah, BeliefNet, that's it. Yeah. Same sort of method for writing an essay or an opinion column or a poem?
You know that those old Westerns we used to watch where the fellow would come in from his mine with a bag of dust to have it assayed? There's a connection between that test, that search for the real gold, at work in essaying. Essaying is a test, is a measure, is a search, is a sort of setting forth in the way that writing poems is a setting forth in search of something that rings true, that seems golden at the end, you know. So to me, they're very much the same thing, and in a way that, the line and the stanza may be the units of measure for poetry, for essaying, the sentence is the thing, and the... And the manipulation of white space is important, too, in both cases. You know, how big of a leap do you trust the reader to make?
It seems whether it is your poetry or an essay, and you might be writing about your town, or you might be writing about the execution of Timothy McVeigh or the abortion debate, you seem to dislike empty talk a lot.
I feel challenged by certain predicaments. You know, these existential vexations we find ourselves in. I was thinking yesterday was the anniversary, 3 years ago, of, the president's landing on the USS Abraham Lincoln dressed up in Top Gun duds, mm-hmm. You know, under a banner that said mission accomplished, you know, and... At the same time, there was a boy being buried in Granville, Michigan, 28 years old. This blue-eyed, you know, Dutch Reform boy from a good Christian household, who didn't get word that major combat had been stopped 3 years ago in Iraq. He and two other Michigan soldiers were killed last week in this. And when those things happen, there is no vote we can take. There is no check we can write. We don't have exactly the prayers for those things, but the prayer gets closer to it. This raised speech, this raised level of inquiry or entreaty is something that interests me in poetry and you mentioned McVeigh. In the very same way that we are prevented from watching an execution done in our name, we are prevented from seeing the bodies of soldiers brought back from a war that is being waged for our sakes, we're told. This seems to me at odds with, the human obligation to witness and remember and monitor and watch and record. And I think writer's work is to record some of that.
Don't you think a lot of us don't want to see?
Yeah, of course. And it's the same thing, you know, when someone we love dies. You know, we'd rather remember them the way they were, like before they got cancer or drowned or got hit by a car or fell off the globe for whatever reason, you know, before they got breathless and still and spoken of in the past tense. But this is something, it's catching on. It's 100% of the people who are born die. Yeah. And we are members of the only species that seems to take note of it. We are. I mean, that really does separate us from the rock bass and the philodendra, that we know that we're going to die, and we know that those that we love are going to die. And this is a signature of our species, and I think it's worth keeping track of.
Lynch and Sons Funeral Homes in Milford, Michigan. Mm. What's the population of Milford?
I'd say 15,000.
We can call that a small town.
Yes.
I grew up in a small town of about 500 or 600. And what I found interesting when you write about Milford, Michigan is, I don't know, there seems to sometimes be this romanticism of small, the making it into Mayberry. And you peel that away. There's one just small passage where you write about your wife. You and your wife are taking a walk, and she notices the fine gardens and the architecture. But what you're thinking about is that is the house where the two teachers were found after they had asphyxiated themselves in their automobile. Mm. Or that's the room where we had to repaint after a gentleman's suicide. So you do you get that same sense that sometimes small towns are romanticized and
in the way the large towns are? We think we always talk about, you know, the Big Apple and forget about, you know, the rotten core where we have to pay too much for parking. You know, it's just or where people don't know one another. The fact is that nothing. The good news is always the bad news turned inside out. You know, that that ethnicity does kill us and connect us at the same time, and that a small place where everyone knows each other is the place that is full, on the one hand, of goodwill, and on the other, of gossip. So to know your neighbor's business can be a blessing and a curse. And this is the human condition, of course. And yeah, I'm interested in those things. I'm interested in the ways in which what seems like the good news becomes suddenly the bad news, because it replicates, I think, life as we know it, you know?
Thinking of good and bad, do you read reviews of your work?
Oh, yes, yes. And I do remember the bad more than I do the good. It's true. It's a character flaw, but I do.
Why do you think you read the reviews?
I was just doing a class here with Dr. Heffernan and his writing students, and I asked them, why do you write? And one very honest young woman said, to be read. Mm. It's the truth. It's I think anybody who, you know, who makes music, makes art, makes noise in any way, whether it's on the page or on the wall or out in the air, wants a witness. That's what we're looking for.
Thomas Lynch, thank you so
thank
much for your
you,
time.
God
appreciate
bless.
It.
Take care.
Thomas Lynch, writer and undertaker, talking with me in May 2006. You can find out much more about him and what he's written in the 18 years since our conversation at thomaslynch.com. And this is Ozarks at Large for May 16th, 2024. The effort to find a new theme for KUAF's Community Spotlight is rounding the final turn. Dozens of musicians entered original material to be considered the new theme. Three finalists have been selected. The winner, by the way, will also receive free recording time at East Hall Recording Studio. This week on Ozarks at Large, we're talking with each of the three finalists. Yesterday, Jasper Logan, KUAF's Community Engagement Manager, and I sat down with Caden Blake. Caden's composition, Dusk, is among the three final possibilities. Caden says he took a do-it-yourself approach to his musical submission.
I recorded it in my bedroom with this really cheap equipment, basically all I had. And I used this $200 Squire Strat, and I used this synth I had just gotten from my dad and my mom. And that was basically it. That was all I had.
Amazing. And so, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to ask you, Jasper, since you're the musician here, besides Caden, sometimes all it takes is inspiration, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's crazy nowadays. I mean, back in my day, like, I'd be lucky if I could get into a studio and if I could save enough money to, you know, get into a studio. But nowadays, I mean, you could just you can get stuff done on your phone. Like, people can just plug straight into their... I've seen people plug guitars straight into their phone and just, like, record all this stuff. And so it's a good time to be a musician right now, I feel like.
Definitely.
What inspired you to enter the contest?
Actually, that was my fourth grade teacher. She is a frequent, I guess, listener of this station. And she was like, I've been hearing about this theme song contest every single day on my way to work. And she was like, you know, Caden would be really good for this. And so she reached out to me, actually. And she was like, you should submit a song. And I was like, because I was really nervous, actually. I was like, And then I was like, okay, I will. And I submitted Dusk, and here we are. So I would not be here without her.
Did you create Dusk for this, or had you already made it?
I had already made it. Okay. It would have been like, I think, like 6 months old by then. I made it in last September when I was 14.
What made you go, I'm going to use this one?
Because of the reaction people have had, like in general to it. Like my mom, she really enjoyed it, and my friends really enjoyed it. They said it's like a pleasant song. I was like, this could go with the radio station. Yeah.
So did I just hear you say 6 months ago when you were almost 14?
When I was 14.
When you were 14.
So I just turned 15 in March.
Yeah.
Okay. That's great. What do you find about producing music that's so enjoyable?
For me, it's the end result. Making it can be sometimes very frustrating. I think it took me probably about 30 takes, because not only did I have to recreate the song from memory because I originally recorded it on this little small little 8-track, but I lost all the data on that thing, and so it was gone. And then I had to remake it in my mind on my computer as a new edition of it. But the end result is always the best part because you get to see people react to it, and that's my favorite part.
Speaking of people reacting to it, people have been reacting to yourself. Talk a little bit about that. Of like I'll look on the Instagram and I'll just see like comments from it, what seems to be maybe other like your classmates or
a lot of my classmates.
Yeah, there was someone that maybe was like your choir teacher.
Oh,
that
yes.
Was
like, yeah. Shout out to FHS choir.
Yeah. talk a little bit about how like you've been able to kind of rally that support from FHS in like such a short amount of time. I mean, it's been like 3 days.
It's been crazy. Really, a lot of it is my friends doing the work. I have not really pushed it too much, but they have, and the word has spread all around the school, and everyone who can is supporting me, and it's really, I'm really grateful for it, because it's crazy to see that many people unite. And it's a good part of music, is because it brings a lot of people together, and it's really awesome to see.
What's your fourth grade teacher's name? Let's give her a shout out.
Yeah. Her name is Brooke Buckley. I think she's at Washington Elementary now.
Yeah. That's cool.
Yeah. Right.
That's cool.
Well, so shout out to her.
Yes.
Shout out. I would not be here without her.
All right. Finally, I got to ask, what will it be like if this is the ultimate winner and your composition is heard by thousands of people every weekday?
Oh, man. I can never fathom that. I can't fathom that right now either. I will be completely shocked and very excited and grateful, and I think it'll be really a good step forward for me and my music. It's very inspiring, so thank you guys.
I got one last question. If you win the competition, do you already know what you want to go record?
Oh no, I have no clue, but I do know that if I can come up with an idea at my house and then go to the studio and record it, then that'll be really, really nice.
Nice.
So, yeah.
Well, congratulations on making the final three.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks.
Caden Blake is one of three musicians whose musical submission is a finalist in the contest for a new theme for KUAF's Community Spotlight. You can learn more about how you can be part of this process by going to the KUAF Instagram feed. Caden talked with Jasper Logan and me in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio yesterday.
Howdy, folks. This is Dave Smith, host of Ozark Highlands Radio. This week, we take a special road trip to Rogers, Arkansas Rail Yard Live Concert Series, featuring singer-songwriters Will Gunselman and Ashton Barbary. Jeff Glover offers a recording of Lenny Wallace, and Aubrey Atwater explores the theme of riddles and trick questions in traditional folk music. This week on Ozark Highlands Radio.
Ozark Highlands Radio, Saturday evening at 6. Ozarks at Large, produced by 91.3 KUAF in the Carver Center for Public Radio in downtown Fayetteville. Contributors today included Daniel Carruth, Lainey Kellybrew, and Paul Gatling.
Today's program was produced inside the Bruce and Ann Applegate News Studio 2.
When I told you earlier that I was going to have archives from May 2006, what's the first thing you said to me?
I said that I was a sophomore in high school in 2006.
And then what did I say?
You said, stop telling me those sorts of things.
I certainly did. We'll be with you tomorrow. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Matthew Moore. Be well.
Botanical Garden of the Ozarks presents Chefs in the Garden, its signature spring fundraiser, May 21st, 5 to 8:30 p.m. Guests are welcome to enjoy live music, local libations, cooking demonstrations, and tastings by area chefs, all while supporting the garden's mission. Tickets available at bgozarks.org. Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art in Bentonville invites guests to explore nature's wonders at their exhibition, Exquisite Creatures. Open now and on display until July 29th, this exhibit showcases the colorful animals, plants, and minerals found in nature. Tickets and information at crystalbridges.org.